Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello and welcome to the EDH Retcast, where we're all about Commander data and dad jokes. I'm Joey Schultz, and I'm joined as always by my fantastic co-hosts. Up first, he has the gall to build the new Galta. It's Matt Morgan.
Everyone knows that pizza is a delicious dish, but what people don't realize is that pizza is also pretty profound. Sometimes it can be a deep dish.
Oh, wow. Now I'm just hungry, Matt. Now I just want pizza.
I mean, I'm sorry, Dana. I saw you just kind of tossed your hands up for this, so I'm sorry.
I was just thinking that there's a MagicCon in Chicago where you can get deep dish pizza in the not too distant future. So there we go.
Oh, dang. All right. There and is. By the way, yeah, that's our next host. Hi, Dana. It's Dana. Welcome, Dana.
How many goblins does it take to paint a house?
Oh, no. Do I want to know the answer?
It depends how hard you throw them.
Oh, no. Oh, you know what? Goblins are just such a fun quintessential thing in Magic. And now I'm just thinking of like all of those amazing goblins being flung at things in the artwork. Yeah, Dana, yeah. I love that.
I mean, to them, it's just the goblin game. So
that one, I'm less of a fan of.
I mean, it's actually like probably the real goblin bombardment.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. And Goblin Game is actually, like, my little brother's, like, one of his absolute favorite cards, so trust that I've certainly
I don't like your brother
it.
Anymore.
Oh, no, you guys would get along like a house on fire, trust me. His sense of humor is very similar to yours, and you would both have an amazing time antagonizing me in-game for the laughs or stealing my segues and things like that. Don't worry.
I mean, speaking of which, it is about time for Challenge of Stats, so why don't we get to that real quick?
We haven't even said what the show topic is, Matt. Dana, what are we talking about this week?
We're going to be talking about decks that play a little bit slowly.
Yeah. What'd you call this one, Matt? The Curse of Long Games.
Long Games.
Yeah, decks that can sometimes produce a game that goes longer than maybe we all have the bandwidth for sometimes. And not just what those decks are, but what do we do about it when we find ourselves playing against or playing with a deck that can cause a game to go, like, you know, way over an hour, sometimes even 2 hours or things like that. Let's dive into what that's going to be after we give a couple of quick shout outs.
First, I'd like to thank Chase, also known as Mana Curves, for their help in editing the show. You can find them on the interwebs at Mana Curves.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by liking this video, subscribing on YouTube, subscribing to a local podcast app too, or you can go over to patreon.com/EDHRetcast, where we have patron tiers of all sorts of levels, whether you want to join our Discord community, see me steal the segues a day early, or you can get that weekly patron shout out, which is always coveted. So this week we are going to give a very, very special shout out to Kian Dark, and hopefully it's not too dark over there. Shine some light on that last name of yours, Kian, but either way, I'm glad you did see the light and came over to patreon.com/EDHRetcast.
Matt, I love how you really always key in to our patrons' names to find silly jokes to say about them.
I do. I don't want to leave the listeners out in the dark, so I...
Perfect.
I'm done. We can move on now. But thank you, Kian, either way.
And I want to make sure that we don't accidentally give the impression that we only choose listeners with names that we can make dad jokes on. Right. No, it's just that we just like have to make dad jokes about any name. This one happens to lend itself really well, Kian. Super appreciate it. But like, Matt will find dad jokes for even the Joe Smiths of the world too. Like, Matt is dedicated to his craft. So Matt, how about you get us started off with this topic? We're talking about those long games. And when it comes to long games of Commander, ones that start to strain your attention, where's your brain at with this, my guy?
Well, we kind of did a similar topic a while back, episode 231, about dirtly commander decks, commanders that can kind of like sit around and take a lot of game actions, but don't really do anything to forward a game plan. So we wanted to make sure that we're kind of making a distinction between dirtly commander decks that kind of just spin wheels sometimes, and the difference between that and long games, as in you're doing a lot of things, you're forwarding the game plan, but sometimes it just takes a while to really turn that corner. So we really want to take a look and look at certain strategies, certain decks specifically, that maybe take some time to get into a winning position or close the game out, even if it's not really being a dirtly type of deck.
And maybe talk a little bit about how to fix that, ideally, if you find yourself with one of those decks or in that position.
Yeah, exactly.
And this was inspired a little bit by Matt this past weekend in Vegas playing with your brand new Tom Bombadil deck.
Yeah, it did have a few problems, mostly taking all the game actions. And it's a Saga deck. And if you haven't seen a Saga before, it requires you to take a lot of game actions. And therefore, there's a lot of time spent making decisions, making, you know, all sorts of different plays. Therefore, just the more plays are going on, the more time it takes to actually resolve all of them. And it just, yeah, I tried really hard and I played it as fast as I could. But sometimes you can only do so much considering the cards that are in the deck.
Yeah, so what's interesting with that deck too, and what's, I guess we can kind of break this down a little bit because that's a perfect example. So you're playing a bunch of different sagas, and there's a bunch of things with those sagas that consume game action playtime. You know, if you are playing a creature-based deck, you're going to, you know, play your creatures that you can play that turn and look at the ones that you have already had in play and determine like what my best attack is, do your attack. If there's a few triggers, do your triggers. Move the end of the turn, that's basically it. In this case, every individual saga you have to read because they're all going to do a different, because they're all going to do a thing every single turn.
Like three different things.
Move to the next step. Yep, right. So something's going to occur just on the saga alone. You have to manipulate dice or some kind of a counter on every new one that comes into play. And then because of the way Tom works, once you hit the end of that saga, it doesn't just go away. It brings another one into play and repeats that action of like, okay, I need to put something on. I need to make sure Noda does. I need to take that action. So it's not just like one single thing that makes it longer. It's a bunch of different things just mechanically with how that deck works. And it makes it very difficult to speed those things up unless you're like consciously making an attempt to do so.
Yeah, I would say especially the fact that you are effectively cascading into another saga. Yeah. Like that reminds me of another, I wouldn't call the strategy dirtly necessarily, but like cascade decks are also, they tend to do things very powerfully. If you've played against the first Sliver or a Yidris deck before, they're cascading into so many cards, they will often take over a board. But that still takes up, Dana, as you said, quite a lot of game time to keep searching and searching and searching and searching, and you're just like flipping and flipping and flipping and flipping. And they're fun. They're powerful. Those decks do a whole lot of stuff, but they still just take a long time for that all to actually occur. And sometimes, I don't know, you just literally get physically exhausted, not even mentally exhausted by some of those tasks. And that's just in the case of the sagas, especially, Matt, in order for those to finally like push you towards an end game, a lot of the sagas that are designed do feel like they are designed to give you incremental amounts of value. And the Kiora bests the sea gods out there, which actually have like, oh, this thing can turn into a proper win condition. Those are a little bit more rare. And I have to imagine that it makes you a little bit like very grateful for cards like Narsi Fablesinger, for example, which actually has like, here's a proper win condition to make sure that this isn't just powerful, but also is just like, this game can finally really start to close.
Yeah, that is the problem. And you kind of mentioned it for a little second there, Joey, that, you know, yes, Saga is not just our one game action. They're three separate game actions that you have to do every single turn, whereas you have a regular kill spell that's going to just pop down. It's going to do the thing and then it's going to go away versus a Saga where it's going to come in, it's going to do the thing. And the next turn you do another thing. And in a lot of cases, they get progressively more and more complicated at the same time. And so not just as you have to pick your target for the first chapter, you have to do your thing, you have to then redo that all over again and then spend probably a little bit more time each turn figuring out how you want to resolve all those things, because the board just gets more and more complicated. And then in the case of resolving Tom Bombadil's triggered ability, where whenever the saga's basically complete itself, you then start flipping into another saga. So you just start the process all over again as part of another already complicated resolution. So yeah, some of these deck strategies, they can compound upon themselves so that not only it feels like you're doing something significantly more powerful than maybe you might be doing, but that's just because you're taking so many different game actions.
Now, one thing I observed, I'm not even sure if you were aware that you were doing this, but I think I played against a deck two or three times this weekend, twice at least. By the second, or by the last game, we'll say, you, number one, I noticed you had your sagas up on the kind of inner corner of the playmat, closest to the most amount of people for readability. And you were very carefully already, like, when it came time to do your sagas, you're like, okay, I'm doing, you know, chapter two, doing this, chapter two, I'm doing this, chapter three, I'm doing this, chapter three, I'm doing this. You had already, like, by the time your turn rolled around, pre-planned out, yep, this is doing this, this, you didn't have to stop, like, okay, what's happening now? And read the card. Like, you already knew what those actions were. Mm-hmm. When you play a new saga, you are prepared with the dice that you're using for chapter markers. In the deck, by virtue of being what it is, you know, it was still time consuming, but I noticed over the course of the weekend playing it a couple times, you were already finding ways to, like, scrape off the time in between pitches, like in baseball, you know. You were squeezing those gaps closer and closer together. I think that's the kind of thing with this kind of deck. That's probably your best course of action beyond working on finding win conditions is finding ways to minimize that time it takes for you to do the bookkeeping you need to do to the deck.
Well, and that just goes down to, I mean, we talk a lot on the show about get reps in with your deck. Be familiar with the deck. Know why you're putting cards in.
Yeah.
And thinking a turn or two ahead is super important with any of the decks and strategies that we're going to talk about today, because the more that you practice with it, the more you're familiar with the deck, the more you're familiar with the cards, that's going to help you cut down on that time so you're not fiddling around and okay, I'm in the tank and I'm also going to be in the tank for this thing. And making sure that you kind of do your due diligence on behalf of the opponents, you know, the other three people at the table, because they deserve to have a good experience just as much as you do playing the deck.
And Dana, I have to imagine that it was easy for you to observe some of those habit changes because, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've got a deck that might fall into this type of category too of producing some long games. I want to say that you have a Super Friends deck, don't you?
I do. I have a Jiru with Eyes Open deck. So not only is it a Super Friends deck, it is a mono white Super Friends deck, which is probably the most difficult way to close out a game if you are playing a deck filled with all planeswalkers. It's very tricky. And I actually ran into a planeswalker deck this weekend, Angus McKenzie. So there's a fog ability baked into the commander, which, you know, can slow things down as well. A planeswalker Angus deck that the person playing it was super nice and super apologetic about the fact that the game wound up taking us a long amount of time. As I was watching that player play, I was also thinking about between Matt's game and my deck, the various ways that these things can really slow down and become difficult to fight through if you're not consciously aware of it and working to, like Matt was, speed things up as much as you possibly can.
Right. And at least the sagas are like, they typically are on rails. Like, this is definitely the next ability. With planeswalkers, right, you have even more choices for what those are going to do and choices for how to defend them. Jiru in particular prevents damage to your planeswalkers, and the prevention of damage is also not going to speed a game along anytime soon now, is it?
Right.
So I think that probably gets even more. And yeah, additional reps in with that one are big. But I also wonder, like, a question that occurs to me is, is that a deck that you bring to conventions, for example, or because I don't think you play it even on our stream all that often necessarily either, because you're aware of the fact that sometimes this produces a long game, and at a place like a convention, maybe you've got a place to be. At a place like on our stream, it's just like, we can't, you know, stream for 5 hours or anything like that. It makes me wonder, like, where are the times that you find yourself most wanting to actually pull that one out to play?
Yeah, I didn't bring it to Vegas. I don't play it on stream. I usually play it if I'm playing it, you know, with friends. I don't even usually bring it to my shop. It's usually when we're playing at someone's house or something on a weekend and everyone's, you know, got food and drinking and just goofing around. Because number one, then, if things get long, it's much easier when your friends would be like, let's just scoop the whole game up and play a new one. Whereas that's is a little more awkward when you're playing with strangers or playing at a venue or something. It's easy to punt if things get to a point where it's kind of a deadlock. That doesn't happen that much to that deck anymore. One of the things I've done, being consciously aware of how slow it is I've really heavily leaned into as many planeswalkers that make tokens as possible and tried to turn the deck kind of into a token deck that just happens to use planeswalkers to generate them. Mm. So I do have kind of a, you know, it's designed to move towards a win condition, but like that just doesn't always happen. Sometimes you get weird situations where you're not able to punch through with that damage, and then it just becomes a relatively slow defensive dirtly deck, and that's can be not a lot of fun if you're playing with strangers who aren't ready for that and weren't prepared to sit down for a two-hour game and watch a large chunk of it be you move dice around on various different Ajani's and Elspeths. And in a lot of ways, it's very, very similar to how Matt's deck plays as well, his Tom deck. It's the exact same problem. Everything you do isn't just a thing that's going to then have a very straightforward action. You're making choices, you're manipulating dice, you're reading cards. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Planeswalkers, they're named so similarly, you have to remember which Elspeth has the minus one versus the plus one that makes tokens, that kind of thing. So it can get even a little more complicated in terms of record keeping.
Well, and luckily, at least with Tom Bombadil, like you said, Joey, I always know what the second ability and the third ability on a saga is going to be, whereas Planeswalkers, like you, Dana, you picked Planeswalkers that mostly do one thing, but every now and then you have to kind of weigh a little bit what's the next ability, but for the most part, you know what you're going to do. That was one thing I did notice about playing Tom a little bit more was I already know in my head I have the next ability on the stack already because I'm constantly analyzing the board, seeing what the best target's going to be, what the best thing I should be doing next is. Or sometimes it doesn't matter because I don't need to worry about targets. So kind of the little tips you can kind of trick your brain into doing and thinking ahead and knowing, okay, do I want to not do the plus one to make the tokens? Is there something happening that I want to minus my planeswalker on? Those are some little things you can do just to skip ahead and make sure you're always thinking the one step ahead. That's going to speed up the gameplay enormously.
Well, and that is what sometimes can make it tricky for certain of those strategies out there where your game plan can change because of, for example, how many cards they draw on a given turn, and suddenly that might shift your strategy because this, you know, you've started to do a little bit of popping off, but now you have to change your decisions at every time. I've kind of noticed this with a landfall deck before with Oracle of Moldiah, and it's really cool with Oracle of Moldiah, but when you're looping fetch lands, for example, playing fetch lands out of your graveyard, well, you want to see if you can get that little bit of value by paying the land off the top of your deck, but that means that you have to, you know, sacrifice, shuffle, flip the top card of your deck. It's not a land. I'll get the same Evolving Wilds back from my graveyard, sacrifice, shuffle, reset the top to look. And sometimes I'm just like, I'm just going to shortcut this if that's okay with you guys. I will take the loss of the value there and I'll just get the Evolving Wilds directly from my graveyard because I don't want to worry about shuffle, check. And that can be inherent to a bunch of commanders out there with those weird abilities that just take up a whole lot of extra time. I don't know. I'm thinking of Light Paws right now, for example, where almost every aura that you play is going to cause you to shuffle your entire library. Shuffling takes up a whole lot of time as well. And that can just really start to eat away at you, the player, not just eat away at your opponents, too.
Well, and let's not forget, while we're talking about just different strategies that you have to play quickly, otherwise it's going to take forever. Let's not forget dungeons. That can take forever in a day because not just you're going through a whole journey, you're going back and forth all over that dungeon card. Man, there's a lot of different decisions because sometimes you're not thinking about, okay, well, the next decision, but also, well, I want to make sure I'm getting to that other decision that I want, which is clear across the board. That can take so much time too. And I mean, shout out to you dungeon players if you're able to play them quickly, but I can't play them, but also I've never really tried, so.
Well, so this is an interesting one. In my family meta, we have a Rilsa Rael deck, which is an initiative deck. And honestly, that deck, some of the games can go long, but at least that's a deck that does have that same Monarch situation where players are fighting for the initiative, and that does drive combat forward a little bit. Particularly, that deck is actually so good when you blink Rilsa and a bunch of other initiative creatures that like getting through the dungeon can actually happen pretty darn fast, and a lot of those abilities in particular are very, very powerful compared to some of the other previous dungeons we had before the initiative, like Lost Mines of Phandelver and all of those, where the value is really, really teeny tiny. And so like having something that players are actually battling for can really help. And I think things like Monarch are also famous for this too. They actually drive combat as a form of engagement rather than making you want to not do any combat at all. And that can really get some extra chip damage in that can lead to a game ending a little bit more quickly. But even that still has an irony to it, right? Like I think we've all seen a Queen Marchesa sort of Aikido deck where she gets the Monarchy and then it's a lot of defensive and removal spells to keep the Monarchy to prevent other people from taking it from you. So even those strategies, which do encourage combat between players, can also still accidentally, once you're starting to optimize a deck, still accidentally produce a longer game state because they want you to be a little bit more controlling with the board. And that, too, can accidentally cause a game to go a little bit longer than maybe you initially thought that it would.
Well, the other thing that crops up with initiative decks as well is other players at the table, if they haven't put initiative, having no idea what that dungeon does, or at least from like, okay, I think one room is a scry, one room is something else, but I can't tell on that really weird, dark, playing card style card that's upside down in 4-point font. So you're adding this extra weird thing where you're like, can I read it so I can see what you're going to do next time you do this thing? Look at it again. But you're not going to remember the three choices and the three choices and the four choices and the two choices. So you're going to have to look at it again. And like that, I've seen plenty of time getting soaked up by people who are just like trying to be a good opponent and be aware and make strategic choices. And because of how those dungeon cards are designed, that is a bit of a time soak as well. Mm. One of the things we've been talking about is like fixes, whether it's Matt paying attention to where his sagas are, or, you know, me trying to bake a win condition into Jeru. I legit think if you want to make the experience as pleasant as possible for your initiative deck, you should bring four copies of that to make sure everyone has to have in front of them so they can like just look at theirs, even if they haven't got the initiative, to see where you are on it. I think that would make that experience much better and shave some time off if you did that.
I like that, Dana. Yeah. There are also sometimes strategies where we don't realize when we build them how time-consuming they will actually end up being. For instance, Krark and Sakashima became a very famous competitive commander pairing, and the amount of coins that you have to flip for all of that stuff, that is also just a thing that's going to take forever. I've dabbled with storm decks before because I got a Zephai precon, and it was a storm precon, and it could do some really powerful stuff, but like when I started tuning it up, like I was joking about this with rules committee member Jim Lepage over this past weekend, like resolving six ponder copies off of a 1,000-year storm where you have to look at the top three and then shuffle and draw. And like, you just kind of don't want to even do that. Like that's just sort of a whole lot. And like that alone kind of turned me off of the strategy. I'm doing a lot of very powerful stuff and it might even win me the game, but it was still just very much a monopolizing the game time that made me self-conscious about it. And I didn't know that kind of thing going in. I did a video recently about Gorion, an adventure deck. And a lot of adventures, it turns out, have removal effects on them, which Gorion will copy. But that means you're almost accidentally playing a control deck. So you just sat down, I wanted to play adventures. But it turns out that you're actually playing so much more removal in your deck than you expected. And that is a thing that you have to key in on and just like, okay, no, I have to be very, very conscious of the win conditions that I put into this thing because the shape of the deck is something completely different than what I anticipated when I first sat down to make it. And now that I'm seeing the test runs, like, whew, this is different than I thought it would be. And that's when you have to like really start paying as close attention to what the deck truly needs and focus less just on the value and like, what is the victory going to be? How do I change this so that there's real proper forward momentum?
Well, and that's a big reason I took my Moldrotha deck apart. It was just something that it took forever. I was doing very, very powerful things, but over the course of the game, finding what in my graveyard I want to recur that turn. Do I want to take something on the battlefield, find a way to get it in the graveyard? Do I want to do XYZ else as well? There was a lot going on that just decision paralysis 1000% a real thing, even when you have a bunch of reps under your belt with the deck. And so, yeah, it's not just this decision, I don't know how to make it. It's, oh no, I know the decision that I want to make, but it still takes a process of going through all of those motions to getting there. And I mean, Joey, I know you have a deck that, I mean, it's full of decisions, your Elegith deck. There's so much going on with that thing.
Elegith, that's really one where like what that deck is up to, anytime you would scry instead you draw that many cards, and so it's fun to play like Ugin's Insight and stuff like that where I'll scry six and that means I draw six and then you also draw more cards on top of that. That deck is absolutely powerful, but the commander is six mana, and drawing all of those cards, like, what's blue famous for? Counterspells? It's just like Cyclonic Rifty kind of stuff to control the board. And like, I started to get very self-conscious when playing that deck because I'm doing some powerful stuff. But it's taking me a long time to actually find something that closes up. There's only one copy of Psychosis Crawler that's out there. There's only so many rewards for drawing those cards. And even if I do pack the deck with as many of those rewards as possible, it still can take some time to find them. So I wound up in a strategy where I'm just kind of like, oh, I'm controlling and I'm preventing people from messing with me, but I'm not actually winning yet. And that means that this game is going on 9 turns, 10 turns, 11 turns, 12 turns. And that's especially awkward because, like, I don't know, if you've played a lot of games, you've probably all noticed that, like, the first 6 turns probably last as much time as the next 2 turns. Like, turn 7 and 8 can be a full half hour. So if you're tacking on a turn 9, a turn 10, a turn 11, that's a couple more half hours that can happen just from the number of game actions. So that's a deck that I've really just stopped playing because of how much time it takes.
Yeah, like that kind of deck, there's just so many decisions baked into, like, everything you do. And really, all you can do sometimes is just stop and, like, decide to segue into challenge the stats.
God, oh, wow, no.
I like that decision. That's such a good
He just good bites play. The bullet and do it.
Were you two colluding? Like, was that, were you two coordinating that
we don't,
one?
We don't need to collude at this point. It just comes naturally.
It's kismet.
Is there, no, I'm convinced that y'all have like a secret chat without me where you're just like, hey, set me up for this, because that was...
I didn't do it. You set him up. I was over here quiet.
You got me talking about my Sphinx boy, and that got me excited to talk about the Sphinx boy. Yeah, y'all have just mastered how to distract me.
I guess we can't talk about things Joey likes anymore, which is fine with me. That means more Selesnya for me. So what do you say, Dana?
I think we should play more Selesnya, and we're going to challenge that as soon as we come back.
All right, I'll start us off this week, and I've got our listener-submitted Challenge the Stats, and this one comes to us from listener Brian Sakovitz, who had a recommendation for my Baba Lasaga deck. Baba Lasaga is a commander I honestly never shut up about, but she's got a very potent ability to draw cards and drain your opponents for a bunch of life. But in keeping with the theme of this episode, that is actually a deck where I have noticed that I'm doing a whole lot of powerful things, but I'm not always turning the corner and winning the game, because 3 life at a time can be a little bit slow when you know, your opponents are off crater hoofing for 50 or 100 damage and stuff like that. And so I was looking for other types of win conditions, and Brian gave me a recommendation for a card that I had never, ever considered, but which turns out, after testing it this weekend, it won me the 2 games where I got to see it. And the card is Starscream Power Hungry, which I never would have considered for this deck, but boy did it put in work. I'll actually start with the back half of Starscream here because it introduces the Monarch. You can convert it or something from your hand when you play it to make it a 2-3 vehicle with flying, menace, and haste. When it hits an opponent, they become the Monarch if there isn't already a Monarch. And then, of course, from there, you can steal the Monarchy back. Once you're the Monarch, it flips over to the front side. And the front side of Starscream says, whenever you draw a card, if you're the Monarch, an opponent loses 2 life. And that's really good when your commander draws 3 cards every activation. This only shows up in 15 of the 3,700-ish Baba Lasaga decks that are out there right now. Brian, thank you so much for this recommendation. This card was a dream. It's even 2 types, artifact and creature, if I need to sacrifice it for Baba activations. This really helped me close out games and prevent any long games from happening. I am absolutely in love. This is a really cool one. I'm sure a whole bunch of Monarch players are already familiar with this one because what a potent ability. But if you are also playing Baba, this one really impressed me. Thank you so much, Brian, for this terrific recommendation.
Well, I'll step up next then. So this isn't directly from a listener, but I did see it in playing a game with one of our patrons. So Levi Stevenson, thank you so much for this inspiration, because this card just keeps getting better, I think. It's a very old card. Dana, I bet you know exactly what this one is. So Crown of the Ages. This is a card right up your alley. It's 2 mana for an artifact. It says you can pay 4 mana and you can remove target aura from one creature to another, and the new target must be legal. So with all of these new roll enchantments that are coming out, you might want to move those around. Say maybe you're playing an Ariat of the Charmed Apple deck. It's all about having different auras on creatures that aren't yours, but also it just says any aura. So Crown of the Ages, just being able to instant speed move things around, the versatility of this card is so good. Only in 405 decks total. And I just think there's juicy targets coming out all over the place. Every new set has powerful auras, powerful enchantments that are going to just enchant target creatures, especially if you're playing this Ariat of the Charmed Apple type of deck, which currently there's 3,300 decks for Ariat of the Charmed Apple. Only 30 of them are playing Crown of the Ages. So it's just a very unplayed card right now. Absolutely a gem. Levi, thank you for showing this to me, but also not thank you because this card is scary. So it's a great way, and it's also just a very, very good deterrent. It's going to keep people from putting different enchantments on their creatures because, well, you can just steal it because you can take it from somebody else's and put on your creatures too. There's so much play to this card. I love it. There's a lot of enchantments out there now. Just stick it in your decks, folks.
Your Alpha Authority, your Ethereal Armor,
yeah,
our Ethereal Armor, comrade.
Our Eldrazi Conscription. I conscripted that spell for myself.
Oh, wild. What a neat card.
So last but not least this week, I would like to challenge the card Sigarda's Summons, probably in Zabaz the Glimmer Wasp decks, but basically in any deck that's running Modular. And there's a couple of different Modular variants I've seen out there. Sigarda's Summons is currently only in about 18% of Zabaz decks. It's an enchantment for white-white. Creatures you control with +1 counters on them have base power and toughness 4/4, have flying, and are angels in addition to their other types. The angels part is not terribly relevant. The base power and toughness 4/4 and flying is very, very relevant, and let me tell you why. First of all, of the 23 modular creatures you can run in a Zabaz deck, 3 have flying and 1 has trample. So you're giving 9 out of 10 creatures that you have access to evasion, so they can swing in and actually deal damage to people, something that isn't always very easy. More importantly, though, and this is something I kind of missed the first time, every modular creature is a 0/0. That's not technically true. One of them is a 0/1. But the problem with things that give the creatures a base power and toughness is it doesn't really help if they're a large creature or, you know, even a 3/3 that feels pretty underwhelming. Basically, this gives all of your creatures +4/+4 and evasion. It's an enchantment you can drop and have a pretty good chance of killing one, if not multiple people. And then it sticks around, still buffing your creatures and still giving you evasion for the next turn. Modular decks sometimes struggle a little bit to find a way to turn that corner. It's creature-based attack deck, and that tends to want to have access to green to be able to use some of those overrun-style effects. You don't have access to that in Boros. Well, this kind of gives you a way to do that. So Sigarda's Summons, if you're playing a modular deck, particularly if you're playing a Boros modular deck, should see way more play. It is a killer finisher.
Wow. Yeah, I really like that card just sort of in general, but I especially like that application there. I get the sense that card is just going to come out of nowhere and just totally smack me for a whole bunch of damage in some future Twitch game that we play, maybe. Just I have this like spidey sense about it. I can't really put my finger on why.
Yeah, I have built another modular deck, so you might be seeing that in the very near future for sure.
That's excellent. Well, let's keep going with this topic then. Going back to talking about the decks that can take a real, real long time. And I guess ultimately the question for us to kind of like get around to in the back half of this episode is like, cool, what do we do about it? Like, we talked about like, oh, gold fishing, getting to know your deck, playing multiple reps with it can be something to help you speed along some of those things. Dana, you observed like different placements can also be effective for strategies to make sure that you understand your own cards better and that other people understand your cards as well. I ultimately, though, with some of these strategies, I've really just found myself in a point of just like, not only do I not bring them to conventions, I just kind of almost never play them at all, like that Elegith deck, or I built a Tasha the Witch Queen deck as well. And the number of things that have to go right for Tasha to eventually start making you 3/3s, you have to like mill your opponents and then start exiling their cards and then start stealing and casting their cards, and then you get some 3/3s. And like all of that requires like so many turns of setup that it just felt like every time I would play with this, it's going to be a really long game. And eventually that just kind of killed my joy for it. And I didn't find a solution for those. So help me. Guys, help me. What do you do about some of these things?
I mean, I'm not in a place to be giving anybody any help because I'm also in kind of the same situation with a couple decks. I don't remember the last time I played my AC Tyrant of Gyre Straits deck. Mm. It's just been a long time since I played it because that deck, even when I'm playing as quickly as physically possible, it takes so many game actions. Just landfall decks, like you said earlier, Joey, just the nature of them, you do something that's integrally part of the game by playing lands, and you get benefits from that, whether it's drawing cards or doing other things. And so when you have multiple landfall creatures in play, doing something that you would normally do every single turn just complicates the board state so much. That's also another deck. I'm trying to figure out how to fix that without making sure completely change the entire deck. And so I'm also in a situation where I have decks that I can't bring myself to play anymore, and they're just taking up space.
So we discussed a little bit of this in the first half of the show, and just to briefly review that, I mentioned the time between pitches in baseball. One of the things Major League Baseball did this year was like try to find ways to speed up games. And so they shaved off space in between actions as a way to do that. That's definitely something you can do. We talked about Matt moving his stuff around and like being on top of what your next action is going to be as much as possible. First of all, if your deck is taking a long time to get things done, look at that. Like, what can you do to find ways to shave seconds off in between those actions as much as humanly possible? We talked about finding win conditions. You know, that one feels pretty obvious, but it isn't sometimes. Like, sometimes people don't think to do that. They don't think about that. Like, maybe this deck could close things out faster if I just find ways to actually take advantage of all of the things I'm doing. So like those, you know, are the two very first things. If you have a deck that's taking a long time, is to ask yourself, how can I clean up my play to speed things up? And how can I find ways to end these actual games faster with all the things I'm doing?
Yeah.
However, there's maybe some situations though where you can't do those things. Like, the reality is sometimes you will find yourself in a situation where no matter what you do with your deck, you can't squeeze time out in between pitches. You can't find more win conditions than the ones you already have. Maybe you just have to resign yourself to the fact that I'm only going to play this deck in certain places where I know it's not going to be a problem. But I think the first step is like sitting down and taking a long look at that and determining if your deck is one of those ones that is in that position.
Yeah. I mean, so as an example, I mentioned Gorion earlier, which I did an upping the average video for to make the deck, you know, we got a whole bunch of new adventures. How can we tweak this deck to give it a little more punch now that we have a bunch of new adventures for this commander that cared about adventures and came out at a time that we didn't have a whole lot of them? And the thing that I had to fix most about that deck was that it had like one win condition card in there total. And that's definitely a habit that you like might not even notice that you're falling into because of all of the value that you are generating. So I think that's a very common thing, is to be like, oh, wait, there actually aren't a ton of like dedicated this card wins the game in here.
Well, so the other thing I would say that comes up sometimes or you should try to keep an eye on too with your deck is maybe your deck doesn't have to be doing the thing that you think it has to be doing. Mm. Now, obviously, your Elegeth deck, Joey, has to scry. Like, that's what it has to do. But to go back to my Giru deck, for example, early on, I ran quite a few board wipes in that deck because almost all board wipes don't touch planeswalkers. Mm. So a situation where very frequently I could like cast a Wrath of God or something, and it would remove way more stuff on every other board than it would on my own. That was a very good strategy in terms of making the deck effective. Wasn't a very good strategy in terms of making those games go quickly.
Yeah.
Because, you know, particularly since the best way to win a game I had found in that deck was to play tokens. So I was cleaning out my own tokens and making it challenging for me to get to a critical mass as well. Even though the deck won perhaps more than it does right now, that slowed things up. So I found like I just because that was effective doesn't necessarily mean it made for good gameplay. And as I pulled back the number of board wipes in that deck, and I think at one point it was at 7, and I think I'm down to 1, maybe 2, I can't recall off the top of my head. It sped things up. Like the deck did, just because it could do that, as Ian Malcolm says, doesn't mean it should.
I did a very similar thing with my Tom Bombadil deck, Dana. So we mentioned all the things that I noticed about the deck. I also, in my first playthrough, I noticed that I don't need any extra board wipes in that deck because there are several sagas in there that one of the chapters is indeed a board wipe. And so I didn't need any extras. I had six or seven board wipes in there and I just didn't realize it because they were all on sagas. I thought, oh, I only have End Hostilities. So maybe I don't need anything else. But it turns out I didn't even need that because it turns out that there's the phasing of Zalfir, for example, that blows up all the creatures. And so there's a lot of different sagas that I realized, oh, yep, that's going to take out a whole bunch of other pieces, which freed up space for cards that I could play significantly quicker, or at least let the table play significantly quicker. I wasn't blowing up as many creatures because I didn't need those extras because I had so many already, but also I was able to recur them. Mm. And so there was a lot of different reasons that I didn't need to have extra removal because the deck already had so much involved just with the sagas that I was playing to begin with.
And when we were talking about finding win conditions for your deck too, don't be afraid to think outside the box a little bit. You know, if you're playing green and you have a creature deck, it's pretty obvious there's a bunch of different overrun spell effects you can put in your deck. Like, okay, that's obvious. And if you're not doing that and struggling to win games in green, well, then you should probably do that. But it's a little bit more difficult, say, in Joey's Elegith deck, for example. But, like, look at Matt's Saga deck. You're playing with a bunch of enchantments in that deck. Maybe you will find yourself in a position where, like, something like Starfield of Nyx would actually let you turn your creatures into beaters, and you're going to have way more enchantments than somebody else has to swing in. Maybe that won't work in that deck, but, like, it's the kind of thing that you can take a look at that maybe you wouldn't ever consider running anywhere else.
Well, and especially that's a fun example, Dana. And I'm going to use fun as my word there because optimized, I don't think is the right word. Once you turn those enchantments into creatures, you risk them getting removed.
Absolutely.
A Settle the Wreckage or something like that could totally blow you out.
Mm-hmm.
But even if that happens, I still think that's kind of a fun state of gameplay. Like, does this actually work? It's a potential win condition that actually, like, yeah, there's a flaw in it. There are problems with it. But it's still, like, if it works, that's going to be kind of awesome. And even if you get blown out, I mean, that could also be kind of a fun memory to create with it as well.
Absolutely. Sometimes losing in a way that generates a good story is better than winning 45 minutes later in a game that's kind of a slog.
Yes. Yeah, very much. And I think also, like, party to this is that there are a lot of commanders out there where the game state that they produce is just kind of always going to be a very controlling type, I suppose. Like a Toxrill deck, for example, or Hinata can reduce the cost of all of your spells by so much that it's like you're paying one mana to kill off a whole bunch of creatures on the board. There are only so many ways to build that, or like a Negan deck is going to be all sacrifice. And that's going to cause a lot of like, oh, your opponents aren't doing a whole lot of stuff. We've probably all even seen like a Brago deck where like you're blinking a whole bunch of stuff. Some of those things might be removal effects that you're blinking. I had a Marin deck where I was just looping removal creatures all over the place, and those were producing a board state that was very effective, but wasn't even necessarily fun. And eventually I took that Marin deck apart and I changed it into something else because what I wanted were those fun moments for sure. Because the problem arises when you have controlled the board, you've stopped other people from doing stuff, and you're doing things that are optimal, you're doing things that are powerful, and those are fun to do. But whatever the rift is between the moment that you've got control of the board and however many turns it takes for you to actually close out that game, it just can't, you can't take a huge amount of time on that. You got to find a quick win condition between those two moments. Otherwise, it's really going to strain your own attention even. And that's where I think things can get really, really thorny, because as you try to increase the potency of your win conditions, maybe, for example, a Brago deck would add a combo. And that's yet another thing that can rub players the wrong way sometimes. Mm-hmm. So even then, when you are dedicated to finding other win conditions, it can still get thorny. So I like your suggestion there of one that I just think is like, oh, that's just fun. I think that it produces interesting stories. But when finding win conditions, it can sometimes also accidentally oops you into a power level maybe that you didn't even intend to be.
Certainly.
And that's where it just sort of compounds upon itself and it sort of spirals from there too.
And another big factor in this is in a lot of decks, people still play tutors. I know the three of us have kind of actively been taking them out of our own decks.
Mm.
But for a lot of folks, I mean, tutors are still some of the most commonly played cards in the format. And so for folks that do still play tutors, be careful what you tutor for. If folks know that you're tutoring for win conditions instead of tools or utility pieces, whatever that, you know, we typically will still tutor for now and then, that will go a long way too in maintaining the goodwill. And so, yes, you may not be closing the game near as quickly, but you're also creating a maybe a little bit better play experience because you're playing maybe to react a little bit better instead of being proactive, I guess, if that makes any sense there.
No, yeah, I think proactive is a really good word for this. Because especially once we start like tuning and optimizing a dex, like we want to do the things powerfully. And we know from experience that mm-hmm. we can't just let our opponents run rampant. We need to have some removal to keep all of the other players in check, because if they're allowed to do their thing, they might just win the game. But getting those balances right can be so, so difficult. And trying to be very proactive with your own deck rather than just reactive to what other players are doing is certainly going to be helpful. But it still can cause you to accidentally fall into those moments of just like, ah, I've accidentally caused the game to go like three extra rounds, and that's a whole lot of extra time. I don't know about you guys, but there have been moments where I'm just like, I think like, I just want to sandbag a couple of these spells that are in my hand, because the way that this game would end if I don't cast these is actually just going to be like way more fun that way. Like, I think that would be a better ending to this game of whatever big cool blowout is happening than me playing this one Settle the Wreckage, whatever type of effect, and making it go a little bit longer just to see if I could come back. I'm like, nah, it's already at turn 9, and what they did was really cool, and I'm kind of satisfied with that being the ending.
Yeah, that's absolutely something to consider. Like, you don't have to play some of the things that I'm making your deck. So
yeah,
you don't have to play them even if they're in your deck. Like, you can just choose to not do that. Absolutely, sometimes.
Yeah, you really took the words out of my mouth, Dana. Maybe instead of playing those cards that you have to sandbag in some games, maybe take those out and put in cards instead that you never have to sandbag. Play cards that are going to be more proactive, that maybe you're always going to be constantly moving forward. So you're doing a little less in the deck now and then that prevents other players from winning. And instead, you're just worrying about your own game plan instead. That way you never have to worry about, oh, well, I kind of want to make a suboptimal play because it's going to make for a better experience. Just play cards that always add to the experience then. And that just goes into the deck construction rules. And again, knowing your deck, knowing why you put cards in your deck, having that intentionality that we love to preach about on the show all the time. That to me seems like such a better option instead of cards that they're going to sit in your hand because, well, sometimes, maybe 50% of the time, this isn't going to benefit the game experience.
The kind of last point I want to make here is maybe make a sales pitch. There's a lot of reasons you want to speed up games to make for a better experience being the primary one for everyone involved. But I will note this, the deck I mentioned this weekend, the Angus McKenzie deck, the player in question was able to get the Ajani ult off that made it so all damage is reduced to one. Damage dealt to Planeswalkers and to the player is reduced to one regardless of how big that hit is. That was one of the things that made it particularly hard to carve through that deck. The player was super nice. He was aware he was creating a slow game state. We had a good time still, but we all tried to kill him.
Yeah.
And successfully did. The entire table teamed up, and he was the person that got knocked out. The reality is, when you are the person creating a slow game state, very often you're going to put a bullseye on your head. So, like, beyond just making things fun for people when you try to speed things up, there's strategic reasons to do that. It might well make your life a little bit easier and make it so the whole table isn't simultaneously gunning to take you down.
I really like that, Dana. It can be fun to root against an archenemy, too.
Absolutely.
And so there are also ways for you to lean into that experience. This is something that Krim at the Asian Avenger, if y'all are familiar with him, when you play Commander with him, he's the heel, to borrow a term from wrestling. He creates, he just absolutely will pop off and become the archenemy. Everyone has to work together to deal with what he is doing, because if you don't work together, he will win that game. And in some contexts, that can be a very frustrating experience where someone is playing something that you all have to deal with or else. But Krim is such a fun personality to play games against because, yeah, it's frustrating, but he leans into that experience and makes it joyous for everyone else as well. One of my bigger pet peeves, I think we did an episode about Commander pet peeves. One of my bigger pet peeves is if someone is doing something super obviously powerful to the entire table that everyone does have to deal with, but they kind of like try to deflect or like be like, oh, did I do that? Like they try to pretend that they're not the threat that they truly are. And I much prefer someone who can take what might have been an unfortunate game state in some contexts and really find the joy that can still be accessed from those moments by leaning into just like, no, I am the archenemy. I'm being rowdy about it right now and you do have to deal with me. And I hope that you can. Let's see if we can all craft that experience together as opposed to, you know, just don't be weak sauce, right? So I think that those are other tips that you can find from that as well. If you do produce one of those game states, leaning into that experience and being the heel can be fun for people to root against. That can still be an experience that you craft.
And I would kind of just say in a general sense, it never hurts to spend a couple minutes just pondering the play experience for all of your decks, even ones that aren't particularly slow in how long it takes to close out to win. Think about whether it's a good experience for everybody else, even if it's a fast deck. That's, I think, a useful experiment to conduct, you know, once a year or so, is just kind of do a performance review of how they're doing and how that, not just for how they perform really and how well they win, but like how enjoyable are they to play against and what things can you maybe tweak a little bit to make that a better time for everyone.
Yeah, honestly, Dana, that's got to be the most important thing, right? Like, you and I are both tracking all of our games that we've played this year, which is a lot of interesting data points about like, oh, which of our decks are winning the most? How long have those games gone? Like, I'm tracking game length and stuff like that. But the actual most important data point that none of those numbers are really going to show me are just like the most fun times. And that's truly the thing that we ought to actually focus on, because the reason we talk about this, the curse of long games, is because those are the ones that do kind of weigh a little bit heavier on us that we don't always have as much fun with. The point of this is, again, to come back around to how do we craft something that is enjoyable for other players? You know, it's not that all long games are going to always be miserable or anything like that. It's more about, has something happened that took a little bit of fun away, and what can we do about that? But yeah, this was interesting, listeners. We would love to hear your thoughts about long games, decks that can produce that, strategies. Maybe do you play these? Do you avoid? Do you have any tips to share with your fellow listeners? If so, leave them in the comments. We'd really like to hear from you. But for now, fellas, I think we've got to call this episode to a close. So if our listeners want to get in touch with us, where is it that they can find you? Matt?
So you can find me on the social medias at Mathemus55 on any platform, really. You can find us also Wednesday evenings over at twitch.tv/edhrecast when we stream. We have guests on. We're always playing Commander. It's always fun. So make sure you tune in for that as well.
And Dana?
You can find me on the interwebs at Dana Roach. I'm writing articles for EDHREC and Commander's Herald. And you can find all of us together at patreon.com/edhreccast.
And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me online, probably on Instagram or something like that, at Joseph M. Schultz. And you can find the cast at EDH Retcast online as well. Plus, if you want to get in contact with us, maybe submit a challenge to the stats, you can email us at edhretcast@gmail.com. Our thanks go out once again to Chase for assisting me with the post-production of the show. You can find them online at Mana Curves. Listeners, we'll be back at you next week with more data and insights. But until then, remember, EDH wreck your deck before you wreck your deck.